10, 9, 8,
7, 6, 5.
Hey everyone, you're listening to the Am I Allowed to Like Anything podcast, and I'm Darian Simone Harvin. This week I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, where I've been working and hanging out for the past few days. While I'm out here, I wanted to record an episode with at least one Get Angelino, so I'm really excited to have Anne Friedman on the podcast. Anne is a freelance journalist who writes about culture, politics, and gender. Her work is in New York Mag, LA Times, Marie Claire, Elle, amongst many other places. She also hosts a podcast with her good friend Aminatou Sow called Call Your Girlfriend, and it's absolutely brilliant. It's one of the very first podcasts I started listening to, so I'm really excited to have her on my own. Anne also has a weekly email newsletter filled with work from herself and other writers from the past week. I think the only regret Anne and I both have is not making the Zola story our plus one, but we all make mistakes. Just know that we were talking about it and a little crazed over it. Other than that, enjoy. Let me know what you think on Twitter at Darian Simone, and subscribe, rate, and comment in iTunes.
First of all, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Because thanks. I literally emailed you. I actually want to tell you how this happened.
Yeah.
So I obviously listen to Call Your Girlfriend, and I actually have my friend who I'm staying with right now lives in Echo Park. We've been really good friends since we were in college. And she's from New York, but she moved to L.A. And then a lot of my really good friends live in L.A. And I stayed in New York. And I can't remember where I found out about Call Your Girlfriend and you and Aminatou. But I just remember sending it to her like, oh my God, like this is so funny. This is so great. We need to listen to these every other week, like right when they come out. And I was, so all my friends know I've been doing this podcast, and it's been really awesome for me just because it's like a way for me to do, like, create content and do something fun. And I was like, oh, I really want to, you know, do an episode while I'm here in LA. I don't know who to talk to, because there's like this balance I'm trying to find between, like, I think it's great for me to interview like all of my interesting friends, but I also feel like that's somewhat predictable and a little boring. Right. So how can I, you know, seek out at least a few people who, like, I don't really know, but I know would be super great. And she was like, why haven't you asked Anne Friedman? And I was like, I don't know. So that's how that happened. And just obviously through your writing and everything that you cover so well, from like tech to feminism to just culture to living in cities, I've been thinking a lot about your op-ed that you wrote kind of in response to the piece, The List.
The pledge
that like we both have to take, right? I believe you spell his last name Erskine, Chris Erskine.
Or Erskine, I don't know.
Erskine.
Yeah.
Something like that. On millennials and what they have to do. And I want to know first about like your initial reaction to reading it, because I definitely had one, and then I want to kind of talk about like your response too, and where we're really supposed to be taking this conversation. Mm-hmm. What are we really supposed to be getting from this conversation about generations, right? So what did you first think about it?
Well, the thing that I wrote in response, it's probably just easier for me to talk about that, because that is how I felt when I read it, which is that it's really easy to point fingers both at older generations and younger generations for either screwing things up or having screwed things up for you. And first of all, the lines between the generations are not that clear. You know, I mean, I technically am a millennial, but also I think I have a lot of things that not in common with people on the younger end of the spectrum of millennials. So, like, for example, I, like, you know, had no internet growing up at home until, like, maybe the tail end of high school, and then it was dial-up. That didn't really work that well. You know, and so I think, like, there are a couple of markers where, you know, someone who is 22, who is also a millennial, is just, has not had that experience at all, you know? And so I think, though, it's also unfair to kind of say, I don't remember everything in the pledge, but he definitely had a thing about, like, looking up from your phone, like, experiencing the world once in a while.
Right.
Which is something that clearly adults who are very much not millennials also struggle with. And so I think talking about the generation that is currently in its 20s is often a way of saying, worrying about what direction is society heading in.
Yeah.
When in fact, it's not just that generation that is bearing the burden for everything that's wrong right now.
Yeah,
in society.
Exactly.
Well, I know a lot of selfish 40, not a lot. I know selfish 40-year-olds just as many as I know selfish 25-year-olds, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that just when I was reading it, it got to the point where I was like, this has to be satire. Like, this has to kind of be somewhat of a joke. Like, I'm not supposed to take this too seriously, but I think that its response rung a bell because it was like on this platform where it was kind of supposed to be taken seriously to some extent. But I think my main question that I would kind of love to hear your opinion on is there's so much, you know, so we talk about millennials now, and there's a lot of content in commentary on this current generation and their will be for the next. Mm-hmm. But I've been trying to figure out, what are we supposed to be getting from these conversations? What's helpful about them? What is it supposed to, you know, like?
I don't know. It's definitely not service journalism, that's right, for sure. I mean, I think that people maybe see it as identifying trends. I mean, certainly some of the earliest big articles that were that attempted to define what millennials are all about. There's like a Time magazine cover, and then there's this, I think she's a sociologist, but who studies millennials' self-involvement. Her name is Jean Twenge, who wrote a book about that, you know, some kind of me generation type book. And those cover stories, I think, were more about defining what does this generation mean. I read, before I wrote that column, a couple chapters of this book on baby boomers and how they were perceived when they were in their 20s, because I obviously was not alive then.
Right.
And a lot of it was about how they were maligned for being so individualistic, mm-hmm. and concerned about themselves before, like, community associations or the church or things that their parents' generation put, you know, pretty high on their list of priorities.
Right.
And I thought that was really interesting because I'm sort of like, huh, is every 20-something, like, bound to be defined as self-involved just because you're, like, it's a period of identity formation when you're, like, thinking about yourself a lot?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe. I don't know. If right. identity formation and thinking about yourself is the same thing as selfish, I'm not so sure about that.
Right.
But I don't know. A lot of these things then just get mixed and muddled. And, you know, it's a way for, like, older people to complain about younger people in the workplace and have some language to do that, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm interested to know, I guess, talking about the range of men and women who are growing up in their 20s, mm-hmm. do you feel like, I guess this is kind of a weird question, what has been your interaction with them? Not more of like that,
right.
But what's your personal view on, I'm not your opinion on them, but I guess, like, working with people in their 20s,
right.
do you have any, I guess, take on that?
Yeah, so things to understand about me. One, I'm 33 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Two is that I've been a freelancer, and so not working alone, because obviously I collaborate with people all the time, but
right.
working not in a traditional workplace for the past 3 years. So basically, when I was working with people in their 20s, I was in my 20s.
Right.
That said, I obviously interact with a lot of people who are in their 20s. Like, you know, I email with them. I know lots of young journalists.
Mm-hmm.
I have friends who are, like, in their early, mid-20s. And I don't know. I mean, I think that there are a couple of things. I remember when I was maybe 25 or 26, I had a friend who's still have, but at the time she was 34.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember her just saying, like, how great your 30s were and how, like, you know, how she was just like, oh God, you know, the phase that you're in, like, I just, it's really hard. I would never. And I remember thinking, like, it's not that bad. Like, I'm pretty
yeah.
happy. Like, it seemed kind of weird to me. And then there is something about being a little further along in your life and then looking back and being like, oh, things really have gotten better. And not that I would ever turn to someone who is 24 and say, like, oh, your life seems terrible.
Yeah.
You know, never like that. I would say that, you know, the stereotype about entitlement or, like, you know, demanding extra attention or extra guidance or whatever other negative stereotypes were kind of implied by that millennials pledge is not something that I necessarily see from 20-somethings. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think that there are some people who are going to try to look for shortcuts to success.
Right.
And I think that like that manifests in every age group for sure.
Yeah.
But I also think that there is something about being in your 20s and knowing where you want to go or having some ideas about what you want out of life.
Right.
That you really can only get there with time. Like, there are some things where it's like, you know, just like someone like Danielle, who we were talking about, who's had this amazing long career,
right.
Or like, you know, someone like me, who's been working for more than 10 years. There's certain things I've only been able to do because I've been working a long time.
Right.
And so you don't want to say like, oh, you sound really impatient, or, you know, you can't do that tomorrow. You need to build up more experience and you need to do this other thing first, because I didn't feel that way when I was in my 20s. I was like, I know I'm capable of this job now. I don't want to wait 10 years to do it.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
So it's a weird thing where it's like, I understand the very real like motivation behind a lot of the behavior that gets portrayed negatively about people in their 20s. And I relate to it. Like, I remember distinctly kind of being in that position. But I also think that there are annoying people of all ages. And sometimes, like, a boss who's annoyed with someone who, you know, wants a promotion without working that hard, or like comes to the office wearing something inappropriate,
yeah.
is going to be like, oh, all millennials don't know how to like put in the work and don't,
right.
you know, and it's like, well, that's not really the case. So yeah, that's, I don't know. That's my rambling thought about that.
No. And I would even say, I feel like a lot of, so I'm 24, and I guess just for these 4 short years so far, when I hear the entitled thing, I get that.
Yeah.
I get that for sure, because it's like, I think a part of it has to come from what we are now exposed to,
mm-hmm.
and what we feel like, and what we have access to now, and what we feel like we can get. So we're like, okay, I know that I can do this. I can kind of reach for this. I can at least apply for this. I can at least email this person. So it's like, I have all these things at my fingertips. That doesn't necessarily mean that you are going to get them right. So I feel like a lot of my 20s at least has been about like self-awareness too, and learning like when you should check yourself and when it's not okay to check yourself, when it's okay to like feel confident and to go after things. So
right. Well, and there's also a difference too between knowing and being right that you could do something tomorrow, and then also knowing that it might take longer than tomorrow to convince someone to give you that opportunity.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
just because you haven't convinced someone to like give you that assignment or give you that job or whatever it is, doesn't mean you're not capable of it now. It just means you have to find, like starting your own podcast, an outlet for that ambition, so that you can prove it to someone down the road. And I think that gap is a really hard thing.
Thinking about careers,
mm-hmm.
I want to know, because I know that you went to J school, and in first of all, you do such a great job of kind of laying out so many of what you do on your website.
Yeah,
it's like a great,
you can stalk me really easily.
Yeah, you can stalk you.
Not like, in real time, but like my the career scope. Yeah.
The career scope is like super easy, like super easy to stalk. But I feel like you've really been writing for like the longevity of your career, like for your career. And I really feel like for a lot of adults, or at least studies show that we switch, at least like even for my parents and like a lot of people I know, they might be doing this for 2 to 3 years and they change to something totally different. Was there ever a time where, first of all, is that accurate that you've essentially been like writing as your career your entire life? And was there ever a point where you like wanted to stop and to do something different?
It's definitely, I am a weird person in that I have always known pretty much exactly what I wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
Like you are 100% right that I am rare. Most people are like your parents. Most people are like most of my friends who have had interesting jobs and maybe have even worked in the same industry for most of their professional lives, but have kind of had different ambitions throughout that.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it's sort of manifested differently in different types of journalism jobs and different like types of ambition along the way. But if you had asked me as like a teenager what I wanted to do, I would say be a writer for magazines.
Wow. That's awesome. You know? Though.
Yeah. So it's weird, but it's great. And it's actually a huge, I mean, I would never tell anyone who was 16 years old that they had to have decide on their career path definitively. I think teenagers feel enough pressure to make choices like that already.
Right.
But I will say that it's been an advantage for me to know that for a long time. That said, you know, it's also, I did go to journalism school. The internships I took were at newspapers, because at least then, I don't know, I mean, I think that this might still be the case a lot of places today, newspaper internships paid, but magazine internships did not.
Okay.
So because newspapers were largely unionized, newspaper guilds ensured that the interns were paid at least something, and at least the magazine internships I was seeing were not paid. And so that made my choice really easy.
Yeah.
But that said, you know, after those internships, I was sort of, I did not love it. I was like, do I want to be a journalist if I don't like working for newspapers? Maybe that's not what I really want to be doing with my life. It felt so far off to write for magazines. I was like, oh my God, well, I don't even know how to get from here to there. I probably have to have a parent who like teaches at Columbia, and I had to grow up in New York in order to get those jobs.
Right, right. You know?
Which wasn't totally wrong. That yeah, would have helped me.
There's always a few that get through like us, and then we end up, you know, doing pretty right. good for ourselves.
But anyway, so and then when I graduated, I didn't get any of the jobs I applied for, and didn't get any of the internships I applied for, and so I got a paid internship at doing communications work at a women's rights nonprofit, which turned into a job, which I took. And then I kind of went, I saved money that year. I don't even know. This is probably truly one reason why I dislike New York, is because when I lived there as in my very early 20s, I was like saving money and working a job I didn't like.
Yeah.
And like right out of college, which are the hardest years, you know, all of that stuff. So it very much informs my feeling about the city too, mm-hmm. to just go back to that city's point.
Right.
But I questioned then, you know, oh, maybe I do just want to like, wouldn't it be easier if I just kept this nonprofit communications job, whatever.
Yeah.
But that was also the time I started writing for this blog, Feministing, which was a real reminder that what I do like to do is write in a way that is not press releases for a nonprofit.
Yeah.
No disrespect to anyone who actually likes doing that.
Yeah.
But that person is not me. And then there was definitely periods during that year where I was like, well, maybe I've been too narrow in thinking that I want to be a journalist for my whole life. I have lots of other interests. I have other skills. Maybe I should try to do something completely different,
mm-hmm.
which in retrospect, I think was more me trying to make peace with the fact that I didn't think it was attainable. It seemed too hard to try to get an internship and try to like break into journalism, and it seemed almost easier to try to consider other options. I ended up getting an internship at Mother Jones magazine, which is still in San Francisco, and so I left New York for that internship, and that made me feel a little bit more like it was possible.
Right.
Working there and just being in that environment, and so I don't know. I mean, I think that I. If you had asked me all along what I truly wanted to do, I would still answer like be a writer. But there were definitely moments where I thought there's got to be something that of the many things I'm good at that would be an easier way to make a career.
So, I think a lot of us obviously have that notion, and I think it also is what leads many people to going off track to what they originally mm-hmm. kind of want to do, and I guess what their dream is. But what do you feel like kept you on track?
I don't know. I mean, I think on some level, knowing deep down that this is the thing that I'm best at,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think that I could have a successful career doing other things, but in terms of matching what I love to do with what I'm good at doing, I think that ultimately this is the best fit.
Yeah.
Or some variation on the type of writing that I do now.
Right.
I also really like being an editor, which isn't the exact same job, but it's in the family.
Right.
So.
And I'm just curious to know, because I always say to myself, well, if I wasn't a journalist, or if I didn't want to write, or if I didn't want to work in TV news mm-hmm. or something like that, what would I love to do? And like, I know that I would love to be like an art curator. Like, I would love to work at a magazine. So do you have anything like that? Like something else, maybe totally offlandish, that you would love to be doing?
I had a, when I was in college, I lived a lot on like those student loans and savings from the those newspaper internships in the summer. But I also had a job where I made and sold clothes for a boutique in my college town.
Oh,
I know. Sewing skills very critical when you are a tall lady like me, slash any kind of lady, I believe. Like clothes are not really like off the rack, built to fit everybody.
Right.
Anyway, so it was something that I did. In part because it was a break from words. Like, obviously, all my schoolwork was words-based and text-based. But also, it was just, like, it was fun. I was, like, I'm kind of rusty now. Like, I adjust things, but I don't really make anything from scratch. Although, maybe a Halloween costume tomorrow. We'll see.
Oh.
We'll see if I get my work done in time.
Oh, my God. That's exciting.
I mean, it's not going to be, like, anything super complex. But
right. It's not going to be, like, Beyonce's outfit, but it's
no,
fine.
No, trust. Nothing could be. Yeah. So, I think that for a while, I was, like, oh, maybe I'll do something that involves teaching other women these really basic sewing skills. Not like I want to be a fashion designer, but like, mm-hmm. how can I, like, this knowledge has really helped me feel better about my body
right.
for a large part. Because then, you know, you start thinking in terms of how do I make this right for me as opposed to like, what size am I? Or like, how do I match some standard that, you know, someone's dressmaker's dummy was matched for, like, as opposed to me.
Right.
And so, yeah, I don't know, that isn't really a job, but something along those lines, I think.
Yeah, but I think that notion, though, is in something I don't even think about. It's like, I really just buy clothes off the rack, and sometimes I don't even try things on, and I'm like, let's just hope and pray that this size 29 fits me.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, well, they're too, I don't know, it's like, you kind of just accept the way that clothes look, but
yeah.
if you kind of can empower yourself with that skill to really make yourself look the way you want to look in clothes,
right.
that's awesome.
Well, because also no woman's closet, I'm sure no man either, maybe some men, but no woman I know, if you opened her closet, all the labels would say the same size.
Yeah.
Like, you know, or all this, I mean, I think I'm like a lot of people where there is like a range from like small to triple XL, depending on the fit and depending on the garment and whatever, you know, and I think that there is something about, like, obviously there's something about media messages that women get about their bodies and how they're supposed to look. I mean, there's a lot of different standards that women are held to, but, like, you know, media is an influence. But I also think that, like, the actual experience of, like, clothing your body every day is part of that, you
yeah.
know? And so, I don't know, it's something that I never did really figure out what that might look like as a career. I never got that far, but
yeah. In kind of like, I guess, to veer into talking about your body, I would say that your conversations on Call Your Girlfriend with Aminatou and just even like talking about your period is like really, even just as a woman, the first time that I feel like I've really engaged, even if I'm just listening, in a conversation about something that like I also go through as well,
like all the time,
like all like once a month, right?
Like so, maybe right now.
And it's like, and I think that at first it was like kind of off-putting for me, to be completely honest, because it's like I was definitely, and this is like going back to like 13-year-old Darian,
sure
my mom, you know, like I did not want to I don't know why I was like this way, but when I was 12, 13 years old, like going through puberty, like I just didn't want to talk about it.
Totally.
I don't know, like I can't tell you why. Like I feel like maybe some girls were more open than others. I definitely wasn't that girl in the gym class who like was okay being naked like around other people.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
It just wasn't how I was. And to an extent, I kind of feel like I still am that way. I can't even tell you why. And I was the kind of girl who like my mom literally had to give me like an American Girl book on puberty, like if you're not gonna let me talk to you about this, mm-hmm. like you need to at least read this book.
I
read it, but like it took me a while to come around to it. I had to read it in like bits and pieces, and then I got my period and I was like, what's kind of happening? And I was like, oh yeah, that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Great. But I wanted to know, like, have you always I guess been that comfortable, I guess, like talking about your period in such an open space, but I guess like, or were you, or what, how did you get to that point, and why did you feel like that was important?
It's interesting.
That's a loaded question.
We never had a conversation where we said we think it's important to talk about our periods.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we just said, minus things about our personal lives, like, you know, relationships with like friends or people we're dating or our families, like things that really are, that I would consider personal now. I don't really, there is something about a biological process that a majority of women also experience or have experienced that doesn't actually feel that personal to me,
mm-hmm.
In a weird way. I mean, in very specific details about like, I don't know, like there are ways to kind of get super gross with it and maybe a little too personal, but,
yeah.
but I think that acknowledging that like, you know, yeah, I'm like crampy as fuck right now. Sorry,
yeah.
can I say this
no,
on the
no,
podcast?
No, you can't. It's explicit on iTunes.
I know, just making sure. Just like trying to remember. But you know, like I am so crampy today. It's like disgusting.
Right.
Or like I just cried at another commercial. It's like like, I realized I'm PMSing. I thought I was insane. But then, you know, yeah. And I think that that also extends to conversations that, like, women should have more often about, like, what, how they feel about the contraception that they're using, or about, like, other, mm-hmm. other things that in a world I would like to see should be kind of normalized health conversations. The yeah. way you'd be like, I twisted my ankle.
Right.
You know, or like, this, the pill isn't working out for me. Like, you should be able to kind of say.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, for us, it was like, we just wanted to have a conversation that felt true to the conversations we have that we don't record.
Got it.
And that is a part of those conversations. Mm-hmm. Not like every time. It kind of became almost like a, it's not a joke, but like, you know, the fact that we talk about it every time is, has become more of a deliberate, more political thing. But it didn't start that way.
And now you get like listener letters about it too.
Totally.
And you guys have kind of also, I felt like, served the conversation in that way too, where you talk about like new ways of, I guess, dealing with your period, from like Diva Cup to like those like Binx underwear, which I have not tried at all. But it's like, I think that you're right, you are doing that, you're like normalizing the conversation, mm-hmm. and making people like me feel better about it,
which is great.
Yeah.
And I think that there's still a lot of work, I think there's like still a lot of work to be done on that front. It's, and not just when it comes to something like your period, but there's a lot of stuff that women don't, I mean, maybe they talk to their closest friends about, but like things that are not mirrored in the dominant, maybe, media conversation, that have to do with just like the bullshit we put up with every
right.
day. Like, I would file periods under bullshit we put up with every day.
Right.
You know, that I think you're starting to see more and more of a public conversation about that stuff. But I don't know. I mean, I think that obviously there were some choices made by earlier generations of feminists to explicitly talk about, you know, how like harassment at work, or like racism in interpersonal relationships, or mm-hmm. like, you know, that, or abortion, like
right.
things that were important to women, they were explicitly like, we're going to talk about this. But I think that there are still just like so many more topics and so much work to be done on that front.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because this is totally switching gears here. We're not talking
sure.
about periods any longer. So obviously I wanted to talk about your newsletter, just because actually Hardcover puts out a newsletter called The Hard List.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, just kind of like diving into like that world and talking about your own newsletter. You were a part of Tiny Newsletter.
Yeah, I can explain.
Yeah, and I really want yeah. you to, because I feel like this has to do with kind of like the growth and the
yeah.
evolution of your own podcast. And I would love for you to like talk about really like that transition and why that had to occur.
Yeah, so I started sending a tiny letter in March of 2013. And tiny letter, I really recommend it as an email sending platform for anyone who just wants to try something in the
yeah.
medium.
How are you using tiny newsletter?
Yeah, so it's the same kind of like, it requires the same technological expertise that it does to send a regular email. It's
mm-hmm.
just, you know, you type it into the field and you can make certain things bigger. And then I started sending it as a weekly roundup of things that I had read and things that I had produced or written or
mm-hmm.
created. And I think part of the idea was for me as a freelancer to have an accountability system to say at the end of the week, okay, what did you do? Well, how have you spent your week? You know, I don't have any boss who's like looking at the total output of what I do. And it can be hard to have perspective on, like, I mean, I have editors at certain publications that give me feedback, but no one is like, how is your career overall going?
Right.
And like, you know,
they're just like, do you have it yet? When can I see it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it's one piece of a big puzzle. And so the newsletter was sort of in part a way for me to put all of my work for the week in one place. You know, that was formerly scattered all over the internet. And then also to kind of catalog what I had consumed and what had sort of inspired me that week, either because it was bad or because it was good or because it just sparked some thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I started doing. I also sort of had a secondary motive, I guess, of thinking, hey, maybe my editors will sign up. And maybe my editors, even if they don't open it, will see my name in their email inbox once a week, and I will just be more at the top of their minds when it came time to make an assignment.
You are so, that's so smart.
It's because I used to be an editor.
Okay.
And I would be
yeah.
like, oh, I met this great writer named Darian, I should totally assign her something someday, and then I'd go on with the rest of my life.
Right.
And I would, when it came time to make an assignment, I would be like, I know I've met so many great writers lately, but like, But who, and it was really hard to like come up with a name. I was always bad when I was an editor at like keeping spreadsheets of writers I wanted to assign.
Yeah.
And so I kind of was like, whoever is top of mind for whatever reason is more likely to get an assignment. So that was another line of thinking. And I think that, I don't actually know, I haven't put all of my editor's email addresses into my, in search to see if they subscribe or not, but yeah. I know I have gotten work because of it. And maybe because more people have read my work because of the newsletter, or maybe mm-hmm. just for that reason of them seeing my name.
Right.
But yeah, so anyway, so again, this whole like wanting things to happen right away. So then 2 years later, you know, I mean, it's not like it was like 2 weeks later, I was an overnight sensation and yeah. it was too big for Tiny Letter.
Right. It wasn't like a month later when right. the newsletter trend was hitting off and Anne Friedman was like on the cusp.
Right, exactly. Like then, like, so fast forward 2 years, it's like now called a trend, which is exciting, yeah. which means I get interviewed lots of places, which means people see my name in articles about email newsletters, which means I've gotten a lot more subscribers. And the sort of, I feel really, really strongly about not auto signing up anyone at all. Yeah. And so I think that there is something great about if someone signs up is because they found it themselves, because a friend sent it to them. It's anyway. So Tiny Letter was very, very nice to me and let me exceed. So Tiny Letter has a 5,000 subscriber limit.
Okay.
Which is, I guess, their definition of tiny, 5,000 people yeah. and under.
I think that's a lot of people personally.
So. I do too. Yeah. yeah. But anyway, but so then I hit that cap and they raised it for me and basically like kept raising it until now I have, I'm just about to hit 22,000 subscribers.
Oh my goodness. That's awesome.
I know it is. But basically it was like, they were like, you can have as many subscribers as you want, but you can't send as many emails as you want. So it's a weird thing. Like by the end of the month, I was hitting my send limit of email. It's hard, whatever. The point yeah. is I got too big.
Yeah.
And they remain very supportive and awesome and are like helping me transition to send it on MailChimp, yeah. which is designed for bigger lists. So okay. I'm actually like, seriously, everything up on my computer right now is like me getting everything ready because tomorrow is going to be the first one I send on MailChimp. Right. So I'm still like tweaking the design. And I think it's going to look really very similar to how it looked when it was on Tiny Letter. I think uh-huh. it should look almost identical. And yeah. then I probably will do a bigger redesign in the near future.
Right.
I'm definitely an admirer of newsletters. Like I get a lot of them and mm-hmm. there's like a lot of them where I'm like, ooh, it would be really cool to try this thing that this person has done, or this one looks really beautiful. Or,
right.
And I think then this is hard in writing and in editing and all kinds of like things you do in media, which is saying, okay, I appreciate that as a fan. It works really well for you, but like what's going to work for me? What serves the goals that I have? And like yeah. trying to pare down all of the like swirling interesting ideas.
Yeah.
is the hard part.
Yeah. It's hard, but it's fun too, I
think. Oh, it's definitely fun.
Yeah.
Please. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
And it also thinking about what I feel like your newsletter is great at too is like news curation, mm-hmm. which I feel like is really, really important. And like even in my bio, I like to call myself a news curator mm-hmm. because really that's like what I like know how to do. And I'm also, I would say like decently good at. So mm-hmm. it's like, I enjoy to do it because there's so much going around there. People are writing amazing things all yeah. the time. People are writing shitty things all the time, but it's like, this is what I kind of feel like you should be paying attention to for X, Y, and Z. So I feel like your newsletter does a good job of that. Mm-hmm. But I'm interested to know also, like, what are some of your favorite places to read on the internet? Just because like you enjoy their work.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, so much. So there, I think that like a lot of people, I rely on friends and people in my network to kind of curate for me.
Yeah.
And some of it is just dumb luck. You know, I happen to be scrolling through Tumblr when the Paris Review posts their interview with someone, and I follow the Paris Review on Tumblr. And
right.
so then I go and I look at that one interview, and maybe it's not great, but I'm like, oh, they have this other thing, and that's the thing I'll end up linking to. It's
yeah.
like some of it is just following the threads of the internet.
Right.
I do get some other newsletters that I mostly use to catch up on what's happened daily mm-hmm. if I haven't been looking at Twitter or whatever. And yeah. I would say that sometimes things from those make it into my weekly newsletter. Today in Tabs and Next Draft. And then I also get like the New York Times headlines emailed to me every morning mm-hmm. because obviously I can go to newyorktimes.com every day. I do all the time.
Yeah.
But it's nice to sort of say, okay, like the editors at the paper have selected these articles from each section as sort of the front page of today.
Of today.
And I don't know if that's how they really perceive that headlines email, but that's kind of how I read it.
You know what? That's so interesting because I would always wonder, are these supposed to, what they believe are the biggest stories of the day, or are they just like what I used to, so that's interesting that you perceive it that way, because I've actually been trying to figure out as of recently, like, what is their logic behind some of it? So
yeah, and I don't know. I mean, one of the things I like about the email is that it's like news articles, a couple of national news articles, obituaries. There's always a few obituaries in it, which I don't always take the time to go to the obituary section, but obituaries are really, really interesting reading.
Yeah.
And I'm always very interested in, like, who gets memorialized. Like, oh, is it, like, another six white dudes today?
Yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
We're going to throw a woman in there today.
Right, exactly. Woo! So all of those places. I think that just an array, Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, this.cm, which my friend Andrew Golis recently started.
Yeah, it's great.
Mm-hmm, which is great. And then these other emails. And then, you know, there are some, I get a lot of magazines in print. And so sometimes I'm good about going to the website and finding that article and linking it in my weekly email.
Yeah.
And sometimes I get a print magazine and I'm like, oh, Reddit online.
Yeah.
You know, already seen this. And it's more about the experience of keeping up with what's happening in physical magazines. That's what I look at them for.
Right.
I don't know. It is really a mixed bag, which I think is how a lot of people read the internet. The difference with me maybe is that I almost never read anything right when I see it. Mm-hmm. I save it in Instapaper or Pocket or whatever, and then go back and read, you know, at the end of the day.
I can't really, and then
I just read in a big spurt, and, you know, often, and then that's sort of how I build the newsletter. On Friday morning, I go and open my Instapaper and say, okay, what did I read this week, and pull out, you know, from there.
Right. I still love getting, like, paper magazines, too. What I still have not read yet is, like, Oprah's feature in Fast Company.
It's by my bed right now.
Oh, my God.
I haven't read it yet.
I know I haven't. I refuse to read it yet. I'm sure when I get back to New York, it'll hopefully be there. But I almost was tempted to pick one up at the airport, and I was like, nope, I'm not reading it yet. I'm going to wait till I get mine. I feel that way about, I get the Fader, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't read, like, the Drake piece yet, or, like, which is, like...
Yep.
Came out literally weeks ago, so I'm thinking I should just read it at this point, but
yeah,
we'll see.
Which is fine though to be late on that stuff. I mean, I don't know. I never feel when someone links to something that is old in internet terms, I'm like air quoting. I mean, a woman I follow on Tumblr linked to this New York Magazine article about Chinatown and how Chinatown has stayed Chinatown due to the fact that mostly Chinese Americans own the buildings and, like, you know, are the city council members that represent it. And it was just a really interesting look at, like, how has it not been swallowed by the gentrification monster?
Right.
And it came out in late September, and I saw her link to it last night. And I was not like, oh, she's so behind. Like, she had a really interesting commentary about, like, you know, this is what I think about this article. And I was happy to be seeing it again and be reminded, like, oh, that is interesting. Like, I wonder, I don't know.
I totally get that. And I feel like that's still so important because there is so much
written. There's just so much.
There's so much of it. I'm just like, who besides the people outside of media are paying as much attention as us?
No one.
Right.
I mean, a few people. Sometimes I think about how, you know, if employers really got serious about saying, you know, you can't, like, let's say that someone invents something that's like, you can only do work internet, like a browser, some sort of like browser plugin that prevents you from visiting anything but a few sites approved by your employer.
Yeah.
Media's gone. I mean, I'm like, media isn't making that much money already.
Yeah.
But I think about that a lot, about how, like, bored office workers are our, like, demographic.
Right.
People who are in front of computers all day who have some time to kill.
Yeah.
You know, like, not people like, you know, my best friend who's an art therapist, or like my sister who's a teacher. Those are not people keeping us afloat. They read at night, maybe.
Those aren't the people who are keeping our lights on. So.
Right. It's like the bored office workers. Bless you.
I know, like, my bored office friends who are like trying to get out of their jobs, like sending me, did you read this? And I'm like, I work in media. Of course I read this already. But okay. So this is the question that I ask everyone, just because I think it's like
important to, mm-hmm. to think about, and I think that people are also really interested to hear about it. Tell me what your dream is right now. What do you think about? Like, what like keeps you up at night sometimes? What do you turn in your head at least for a few minutes a day?
Oh man. Well, you know the Beyonce answer is to be happy.
Okay, that song still kind of like makes me tear up.
I
like.
Know, I know, I know. I knew you were gonna ask me this, and I thought about just saying to be happy and just like leaving it at that.
And then I'm like, okay.
Uh-huh. No. It's interesting. I mean, I think dreams is such a hard when I force myself to really answer this question, mm-hmm. I realize it's all totally attainable. I mean, my dream is like not to own a yacht or something, which is right. not an attainable dream for someone who works in media. You know, right. my dreams are like, you know, like come up with a good idea and actually write a book. Like that's a totally attainable dream.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, I don't know what else. Like, I think that there are a couple of like just lifestyle things. Like I would like to, you know, like institute something that was not work into my daily schedule. So, mm-hmm. So like whether it's taking lessons to do something or like, you know, actually being serious about taking some kind of class. I'm like terrified to take exercise classes like with other
Why?
People. I don't know. I think it has to do with gym class trauma from when I was
okay.
a kid.
Okay, got it.
But anyway,
yeah.
it doesn't make any sense. Like these are all things, like all the things that, I mean, it's not a dream. That's like, that would be a really sad dream to like.
No, but it's like.
But when I'm like things that I'm like, I should really do that would like really improve what I have going on.
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of things that I think about. Or like mm-hmm. when I'm like, can't sleep at night. I'm like, I should really call like that friend more often. I know it's going to sound really sad to be like, I don't have big dreams.
No, but it's just like your everyday right. things that like keep you happy.
Right. Exactly. And I think that when I look at like the body of work that I've produced in 3 years as a freelancer,
right.
I think that I'm like, oh, I can look at that and say I'd like to do more things like this and less things like this. Mm-hmm. And there's probably a way to kind of say, what are the circumstances that brought about this thing I'm really proud of, and how do I try to replicate that and do
yeah.
more of it? I think there's a lot of stuff like that again is not really dream status, but like I just want to like get a little better at the stuff I do every year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you thought about ever writing a book?
Oh my gosh, I think about it constantly.
Because I'm thinking at this point, I'm going through all this work that you've done, and I'm like, I feel like a book should be popping up somewhere
So listen, you are right, but I don't want to write a book just to write a book. I want to have like a thing that matches that format. And mm-hmm. I have lots of ideas that at the end of the day, I think I've just decided that's a great feature idea. That's not a book idea. Like that is a topic I'm interested in and I want to pursue. That's not something I want to pursue for 10 chapters. It's something I want to pursue for 4,000 words.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of it, is thinking about that, is trying to figure out the what. I mean, I have lots of thoughts about how and about like, you know, what format I would want like a book to eventually take. And I have a long-suffering literary agent who's just waiting for me to send her a proposal who like invested in me early. And like, I really do owe her. And yet like, I can't like, I don't know. It's not really, I've yet to sort of find the idea where I'm like, it's the one, that's the thing. I really want to like put half my other work on hold and work on this.
Right.
Like I haven't found that thing.
I'm going to think of some ideas for you.
Please do. I should just do an open call for book ideas.
Yeah, next time you're on Call Your Girlfriend, just be like, Anne's taking book ideas.
I know. And I don't want to, I mean, I want it to feel, I don't want to just like, you know, I want it to feel intentional and I want to mm-hmm. feel like it makes sense as a book. I don't really feel like I want to do it just to prove I know I could do it just to do it. If mm-hmm. I was like, if the important thing was write a book, any book, I think I would have done it already.
Yeah.
I think it's more for me about the cost of not being able to do other things I'm interested in that puts the stakes really high on the book idea. I have to be interested. I'm someone who likes to do a lot of different things. And a book requires like a pretty focused attention.
Right.
And so I have to be really interested.
Yeah. Like really, you have to be so engaged.
Yeah. But I mean, I hope next year is the year I do it. I'm like, I would really, I don't know. I'm working on it. This is like work therapy for me. This is good.
I know. Look, we're talking through our ideas.
Did you feel my damage? Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So let's move on to the plus one segment, which is always like my favorite time because this is like the one structured area of the podcast. But I guess for people who are listening for the first time, plus one is supposed to really run in theme of the podcast. Am I allowed to like anything? That's supposed to be a space where you can really talk about things that you like, and mm-hmm. that's an okay thing to do in society. You don't have to hate everything all the time,
right?
And so plus one is, it can be a person, a place, a thing, anything. It can be anything you want, which I love about it.
Mm-hmm.
So have you come up with one yet, Anne?
My God, I have so many. This is part of the problem, you know? Weirdly, when I was listening to you ask the question again, the first thing that came to mind, and it's probably because I was just talking about it this week, is I'm on this email list in Los Angeles that is run by a woman who is objectively terrible. Like, she is a Pasadena Republican. I'm not sure she lives in Pasadena, but she definitely lives in one of like the sort of like white, historically wealthy enclaves in LA.
Right.
And she runs estate sales. And my good friend Zach, who I used to work with, put me onto her email list, which is, on one hand, it's sort of divided in half. And on one hand, this is like one of the email newsletters I open without fail.
Okay. That's how I, you know, who with what I'm like that with. So Slate puts mm-hmm. out their Dear Prudy.
Yes.
And it's like, I just sometimes live for the headline.
Yeah.
I just live for the headline of the, because I'm just like, are these real?
Is other people's damage.
Yeah. Oh my God. But anyways, yes, continue.
Anyway, so it's this email newsletter that is ostensibly to alert you to estate sales in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
However, there's like a main part of it where she says this week's estate is in Glendale and here's what's generally for sale there and here are the times. But there's this left sidebar, which is her hall of shame, where she just basically like reads someone who has like come to her estate sale and like broken something or tried to haggle with her on price or like, and she is mean as a snake. She is like, she is unhinged and terrible. And I read this and I'm like, on one hand, it is a delight. Like, I'm like screaming and clapping my hands. It's hard for me. I should actually go look one up and do a dramatic reading. But on the other hand, it's usually comes near the end of the week. It comes like Friday because she's talking about weekend estate sales. And it's like all of the things, you know, when you read like a tweet or something and you're like, ugh, like, you know, and you have some bitchy thought about it, but
you don't say
you're
anything.
A nice person. So you don't say anything and like whatever, which I think is a good civilized way to live your life. When I read this email from her about estate sales, it's like cathartic. Like all the things that I have suppressed throughout the week that I don't want to be saying publicly, she just says for me, channeled at just people who did not know better, who came to her estate sale and did not know that they were dealing with this wretched woman.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my like hate love. This is my plus one.
Yeah.
Which is probably not relevant to people who live outside Los Angeles. But if you live in Los Angeles, send me a note and I'll forward her email. Because the only way to get on it is to have someone forward it to you. There's no sign up like online.
Oh my gosh. I definitely want to be on this email.
You have to email her personally and ask to be added.
Oh! Hello. I live in New York City in Brooklyn and I'm interested in estates.
No, you should be like, oh, I'm a mean ass Republican who lives in Altadena and I want to be on your list. That's what you should. Anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's my plus one. Do it.
No, so my plus one this week is actually a music artist. Have you ever heard of, she grew up in Sweden and her name is Sine Bose.
I do not know her.
She is really awesome. Maybe I can even play a little bit of the song.
Oh yes, please.
Because I think that she's just so...
How did you find her?
I don't even remember. Let's see if it plays. I'm going to have to play it on my phone. But... she's like 25 years old mm-hmm. and she just has this voice of, I don't know who to compare her to, but she has such a mature voice. And I think that she's kind of like, she's not poppy and she's kind of filling this void where she's definitely on the come up
mm-hmm.
and her music is getting recognized, but she has this like look and feel that is not 100% awesome. Mainstream. I really want to find
That's an actually useful plus one that people who are not living in Los Angeles with internet rage problems can actually use.
You know,
everyone can use that.
I have to tell you that sometimes I do have problems coming up with plus one. Yeah. Sometimes it is hard to do this podcast because I'm like, this was a shitty week and I don't know what I like this week, but...
I have to tell you, I have like a, I had a potential plus one, but I haven't checked it out yet. A friend of mine told me about this Australian TV show that's on Netflix now.
Ooh.
That's about a woman in the 1920s who's like a boss bitch in her 40s who has all these men working for her, and she solves crimes and has a gold gun, and like it's like a fantasy of, you know, that like the oft repeated joke about how like only white dudes want to go back in time.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, right.
And it's sort of like, I feel like it's one of those, it's like that joke, but if you could rewrite all of history so that you could be a woman like this.
Right.
A friend really sold me on it yesterday, but I haven't watched it yet, so I can't in good faith.
You can't in good faith. I understand that. This is okay. So this play song, it's called Pretend, mm-hmm. but it's really kind of about just like going with the punches of life and like everything's okay.
Mm.
I'm just gonna play it.
Yeah.
First of all, I love that sound.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I'm gonna wait till you hear her voice.
Yes, she's like a throatier, less sad Adele.
Yes, okay,
kind of.
That is what somebody compared her
really?
To, and I was like, yes,
in the best way.
In the best way.
Yeah.
But she's this black Swedish woman
awesome.
from Sweden, and I really love her music. So that's my
yes,
best one for this.
That's
week.
Like such a good one.
Yes. Okay. Well. This has been so great.
Yeah.
I knew that, to be honest, I knew that we would have a great conversation. I just knew it.